You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a number of social media platforms are considering big changes to their services. We'll find out why and what they could mean for you if you're using them. First, new reporting by a team of journalists takes a close look at both the late 80s crack cocaine problem and the more recent concerns with heroin and prescription opioids. They found that the approach to solving both problems varied in many ways and often depended if you were black or white. In many cases, we refer to heroin or opioid-addicted individuals as victims or people with a disease in need of treatment. In the 80s, individuals using crack cocaine were handled with mass arrest and severe sentences. Our next guests were part of the team reporting this new series called Crack versus Heroin that's available on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel website. Andrew Goudsward is a breaking news reporter for the Asbury Park Press, covering primarily crime and police in Monmouth and Ocean County, New Jersey. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Austin Bogues is a reporter at the Asbury Park Press. Austin, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks for having us on, Rob.
Austin, we're living through the opioid epidemic, some people call it now, but take us back to the 80s for people who don't remember or who weren't there at the time. Talk about the crack cocaine problem and how we talked about it.
The crack epidemic, it was really is one of the darker portions of American history. It really flooded urban markets. It became kind of this panic, in effect, in terms of there was a lot of fear about some of the crime that proliferated as a result of the crack epidemic. There was a lot of fear in communities. Some of the violence level rose as well. And it really led to the creation of a lot of open-air drug markets and some of the urban epicenters associated with it. What followed, and as our investigation showed, was a very heavy-handed law enforcement response. And, you know, there was a disproportionate amount of black people that were arrested, but it's a very complex story when you look at kind of the origins of the policies behind that. The Congressional Black Caucus were, you know, some of the leading champions of the lock 'em up first approach. And really, this thing kind of burned out within a number of years. And you saw even early on that a number of people on the policy level and, you know, in the law enforcement perspective, they realized very quickly that, you know, this wasn't something that they could arrest their way out of. One of the gentlemen that we interviewed, he was a special DEA agent in charge of New York City during the height of the crack epidemic. His name is Robert Stutman. And he testified before Congress saying, like, look, this is not an effective strategy. And, you know, pushing for more of a treatment-first approach. But by this time, there was a big nationwide problem with violence in general that stems back to the 80s. And politically speaking, being looked at as being soft on crime, it just was not popular at all politically. And, you know, there was a big kind of impetus, and this is from both sides of the aisle, from Democrats, from Republicans, from blacks, from whites, to kind of be looked at as being tough on crime. But, you know, it's one of those things where, with some hindsight, a lot of the predictions that we expected during the height of the crack epidemic, you know, there was worries about super predators and kind of a generation of lost young black men. It never really came to fruition the way that society feared. And what we have left over is kind of a lot of the people who were addicted to crack during the height of the epidemic. A lot of them, if they live, they've made it clean. You know, they've reformed their lives, but they're left with kind of the wreckage of the criminal history that they have.
And Andrew, there's a lot of data in your series here. Can you give us a sense of how those laws that were passed that Austin was just talking about played out when it came to the proportion of people incarcerated, arrested by race versus who was actually using the substances that the laws addressed?
Absolutely. So, I mean, if you look at federal drug surveys, African Americans are slightly higher than whites at reporting crack use over their lives. But if you look at by the population, because the black population of the country is a lot smaller, there actually are more white people using crack cocaine as there were then and there are now compared to African Americans. But if you look at the way, you know, police and prosecutors and the criminal justice system treated this problem, it was treated, you know, it became a black problem. I mean, if you look at the start of the 80s, you know, the number of drug arrests were relatively small. I mean, there were about 500,000 nationwide, by the end of the decade, as these laws started getting put into effect, you had more than a million drug arrests, and you had the disparities were starting to really separate between blacks and whites. I mean, you had years in the 80s and 90s, and really continuing for decades thereafter, where, in areas in states like Wisconsin, where blacks represent about 6% of the population, where they were the majority of cocaine arrests. And that just shows you, where the police and the prosecutors were targeting this problem. And it was primarily, in the inner cities, even well after, the crack cocaine crisis was solved for the most part, and it became less of a talking point.
Austin, you mentioned one person at the center of this. This is a common theme in your series, people who in many cases crafted these policies, these tough on crime policies, repenting, telling you and others that we got this wrong and we're not wild about the outcomes.
Yes, that's something that we ran into time and time again. From people at the top levels of policymaking to even your more run-of-the-mill kind of street cops. One of our colleagues, he interviewed Eric Sterling, who was actually a counsel to the House of Democrats, and he was a leading voice in helping craft some of the disparities between the crack cocaine and cocaine and powder cocaine, and he's calls it one of the biggest mistakes of his professional career, and he's now he's ahead of a he's founded a two criminal justice reform groups, and he's been a leading champion in terms of saying some of the disparities and the way that the drug laws are applied, they need to be reformed.
Talking to Austin Bogues and Andrew Gougeward from the Asbury Park Press, they were part of a big series comparing the way crack cocaine was handled in the 1980s in the United States and the opioid problems are being handled today. We took a whirlwind tour there, Andrew, of crack cocaine in the 80s. Let's move things up now. What do we see different in our approach to heroin and opioids when it comes to our priorities, including what we're spending money on to deal with these problems?
Yeah, it's been drastically different. I mean, the focus in Congress and in state legislatures during crack, as we mentioned, was all about more money for prisons, more money for policing. And now the emphasis is, the money is for treatment. The money is for, programs that help people rebuild their lives after an addiction. And, and our reporting found, especially among experts, that this is really the right way to treat drug addiction now. But it just wasn't the case back then. They had an undeniable factor in all this, of course, is the race of people who are addicted. I mean, you had in the opioid crisis, particularly at the beginning, you had the addiction problem really centered in rural and suburban places, in large part because the doctors didn't necessarily trust African Americans as much to prescribe opioids because they thought they were at greater risk of addiction. So a lot of the pills, and opioids that set off this crisis that we're in now started in places that were more rural and suburban. And as the crisis has gone along, you've seen politicians now say that openly that, we're not going to be able to arrest our way out of this problem. We have to treat it as a public health issue. And that, has been to the benefit of society as a whole, but, it's hard for people that we talk to who are on the front lines of crack to see, this new approach that emphasizes treatment and compassion and not, wonder, why that wasn't the case for them and why they're still stuck in this pattern where a lot of them can't get good jobs, can't find decent housing because of these convictions that were taken, that happened in another era decades ago.
Austin, I've heard people make the stark accusation that crack cocaine was seen as a black person problem and it was dealt with because of that as a law enforcement problem. Opioids are seen as a white person problem and it's being seen as a treatment problem. Is that maybe oversimplifying, but are people making the case that that's part of what happened here?
It's really an oversimplification of the issue. Clearly, though, I mean, if you look at the numbers, there's kind of proof in the pudding when you look at this is really a thing where, even today, there's more black people that are being arrested for cocaine offenses than opioids, even as we look at, just how deadly the opioid epidemic has been in parts of the country. There's still kind of this lock 'em up first approach that's used. However, though, there's some differences in kind of both how both epidemics kind of started off, and you can really see that in kind of in terms of crack. there was a great level of violence associated, of course. There was with the opioid crisis, the death count has really come more from overdoses and from people who are switched over from prescription pills to heroin or fentanyl and those types of things. But you know, there also hasn't been the same stigma applied to opioid. You know, it's not something that with opioids, it's not something that we joke about in society, or you know, we don't view it as a moral failing. A lot of that is kind of, you know, improvements in the medical community, and also politicians realizing kind of the root causes of addiction. But you know, there's still kind of this legacy of people looking at crack addicts like, you know, somehow they were less than, or you know, they were just moral degenerates who or they were lazy, or you know, it was some sort of choice. Whereas now we view addiction today more as a disease.
We'll leave it there for now. Austin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Andrew, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having us.
That's Andrew Goudsworth and Austin Bogues, reporters for the Asbury Park Press. They were part of a big series, part of a team, a project called Crack versus Heroin. A lot more to read there, including individual stories of people who went through addiction in the 1980s and today. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's website, jsonline.com, has that series. Coming up next, Instagram will hide likes for some users in a new test, and Twitter may soon give users more ways to avoid online abuse. We'll talk about what's behind those changes and how they could affect your experience coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Articles of impeachment and a Department of Justice report on the FBI's 2016 campaign probe. Just another Tuesday, we'll get the latest on two big stories in the nation's capital coming up. Now, social media sites have been under a growing amount of scrutiny in recent years. There are questions about how platforms like Facebook and Twitter have been misused and how that misuse can impact things like elections. And there are also questions about how social media affects our mental and emotional health, with our tendency to only post about the happiest, most beautiful parts of our lives. A number of big social media companies are considering changes to deal with some of these issues. Some are already getting pushback. Steve Knoll is a professor of marketing at Madison College, our go-to guy in the social media world. Steve, good to have you back.
Cool. Thank you.
Well, are we right? Are there a lot of sites making fairly important tweaks here?
Well, I'm not sure about important. Well, you know, we'll see. That's the one thing about the social media world. As soon as you have everything figured it out, it will change. So the biggest thing is probably what Instagram is rolling out. When you post on Instagram, of course, people like it, and then you can kind of see how many likes you're getting, and you can see how many likes other people are getting. What they're doing is they're gradually rolling this out where you will stop seeing other people's likes. You can still see how many likes your post got, but you won't be able to see, like, oh, this friend of mine posted this picture of their cat and got 87 likes, so therefore I'm pressured to post my own picture of a cat to try to outdo it.
This sounds like a little thing, especially I'm thinking of people who don't use Instagram and don't post on it a lot.
Yep.
But there's an idea here that, you know, if our social media service is making people feel bad, inadequate, maybe even discouraging from that post, if they're getting a tenth the number of likes as their buddy across town, maybe that's not such a great service.
Yeah, and that's, you know, there's this expression, FOMO, fear of missing out, and this idea that there's almost this social pressure to compete with people over really inane things like pictures of last night's dinner. And psychologists have been talking about this, and they've been looking at, you know, how social media affects people's mental health. And one of the things they've been finding is there's almost this quest to be liked, you know, literally liked. So I think that this is something that is probably a good thing to try to lessen some of that social pressure.
There's one group I imagine might be concerned about this, the people who are trying to make a living at being a social media influencer, many of them on Instagram, where their currency is those likes and how many people have seen it.
Well, and people posting them, you will still be able to see what your own posts are generating. And I think, you know, Instagram is owned by Facebook. We know that. And ultimately, it's about making money. And they're not going to do something that's going to kind of take away their bread and butter business from that. So I think that it's really more designed for the casual people that might have some, you know, minor psychological addiction issues and trying to lessen some of that before this turns into a major issue.
Now, we've seen stories about especially the demographic of teenage girls feeling more anxiety, more depression.
Sure.
Some researchers tying that to social media.
Correct.
I think the jury may be out there, arguments on both sides. But is this something people are thinking about with a change like this?
They are. They are. The whole idea that maybe a 16-year-old girl would, get a new dress or put on makeup and then, post a selfie. And if it doesn't get 100 likes, she will then feel bad. She will feel that she's ugly or not, looking good. And that's not correct. With the algorithms, a lot of that can determine how many people are actually seeing it. And that will correlate to how many likes are there. So it's not really more designed for the people who are working a business on it. It's really just trying to lessen some of the psychological implications that this type of behavior can lead to.
Now, this is testing. It's being released, as you mentioned, I think
it's
a rolling release.
Out. Yes, it's a rollout.
So
yes.
When might people in Wisconsin, if it matters where you are regionally, see this happen?
Right. And that's the thing is, though, it's going to just roll out gradually, probably over the next year. And they don't really do it by regions. It's really more done by how heavy of a user you are. If you are more of a hardcore Instagrammer that you're on there every single day, you're probably going to see this sooner than later. If you're just a casual person, by the time it even rolls out, you won't even notice it's not there.
All right, that's Instagram. Let's turn to Twitter now. Mm-hmm. Twitter's talking about, anyway, adding some new user controls next year.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like a laundry list a little bit. What do they have out there?
Well, what they want to do is they're concerned with like conversations just spiraling out of control. So they want to limit things like if I send out a tweet, can I set it up that you can't retweet my message? Or if I'm going to limit to how many people I can, direct message, with the @ sign on the app. A lot of it is, we see this, that somebody will post something and then it will just spiral out of control. Now, sometimes that's good. You could have somebody who finds, something, some type of social injustice and tweets it out there and it gets picked up and retweeted and becomes a big phenomenon. Okay, that's a good use of Twitter. But there's a lot of insipid stuff that kind of like dissolves into rants and a lot of like racial stuff like that, that they really just want to give the initial poster the ability to control that instead of letting people take something out of context and then keep retweeting it.
Now, following Twitter sort of passively as I do, it seems like a common complaint, especially from women, is, hey, Twitter, these changes are nice. Can we do something about the like really vile abuse that women in particular on Twitter are daily subjected to?
Yeah, and that's the thing about social media, especially something like Twitter, where you're kind of protected by a handle and not a name, and it really brings out the good, high-quality human beings. But that's the thing, yeah, is that women are saying, well, I'll post something on Twitter and then it might be, saying something, very progressive about a new female-led movie. And then all of a sudden that tweet is being retweeted with a lot of really nasty comments that are very misogynistic. And it's a way to allow that initial poster to cut that off and stop the conversation. I think it's a good thing, but it's hard to say going forward if this is really going to have a big impact on that. It sounds good. It's kind of like Twitter saying we're not going to accept political advertising anymore. That sounds really good. But if you look at the numbers, it's like less than 1% of their revenue stream. So it got them a lot of media coverage and they're like, yay, we're the social media heroes. But really, it's not going to impact them.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College, looking at some changes that may be appearing on a social media site near you. Well, it's Instagram, Twitter. Of course, the social media site that way more people will come into contact with is Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
What are you watching there? I mean, it seems like there's always something, some tweaking going on there.
Yeah, there is. Facebook is always changing. So one of the big questions is with a major election coming up next year, and a lot of money is spent on Facebook. How is, Twitter's announcement that they're not going to accept political advertising, that was definitely a shot across Facebook's bow. Whether or not Facebook is going to look at that, it's hard to say. It's money. They're not necessarily going to turn money away. But I think that you're going to see a lot more vetting of businesses. One thing that I've been following a lot on Facebook is the whole Baby Yoda phenomenon, because every time I log onto Facebook, there's 19 different websites wanting me to sell me Baby Yoda toys. And those are all bootlegs. They're not real. And a lot of these are foreign companies. And, you know, people are just scrambling to get this hot product that's not going to be in the stores till next May. And they're putting their credit card numbers into websites that they don't even know where they go to. What can Facebook do about that to try to protect consumers? And Facebook's launching its own currency called Libra. And it's a difficult rollout. They've already run into some regulatory stuff, but this is one of the things that Facebook wants to do, is they want to serve as a marketplace for you, but there's a lot more that needs to be done to make sure they're protecting the consumer from buying from a company they've never heard of.
And one more trend we've talked about with Facebook, this move for once upon a time was like, hey, everybody's out there in the public, mm-hmm. and that's the great thing about Facebook. Mm-hmm. And now Mark Zuckerberg's saying, hey, the great thing about Facebook is we're going to have these private groups everybody sees everything.
Yeah.
And it seems like they started that and they're moving more in that direction.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, you know, social media takes geography out of the equation. So you're connected to people with common interests, not necessarily common geography. And that's where they felt that a lot of the conflict was coming from. People were conversing still based on, oh, we live in the same city, and then we get on Facebook and we argue with each other. Well, now they want to, you know, move people more to have conversations about topics they have in common, no matter if they live in Wisconsin or if they live in Florida, if they live in Europe. You know, it's that topic that brings them together. And that's really where social media excels.
What else, in our last few moments, what else are you watching for in 2020 in social media world?
Well, the big thing is the elections. And certainly we've now known that social media can be weaponized as a political tool. Mm-hmm. And that's both sides who are doing this. And we're going to see how this is going to start to play out, especially when we get to the general election next fall. It's both sides are looking what can be done, what is legal, and what is ethical. And of course, legal and ethical are not on the same wavelength.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Steve Knoll, professor of marketing at Madison College. He was with us today to talk about a number of new tweaks and features that could change what you see on sites like Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Coming out, we start out the latest on articles of impeachment announced today, as well as a new Department of Justice report on the FBI's Russia probe. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show, we can plan all we want for retirement, but sometimes we have to leave work earlier than expected. Kate Archer Kent talks to a retirement planner about how to prepare for the unexpected at the end of our careers. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, one day after House Judiciary Committee hearing on findings from the Intelligence Committee, the Judiciary Committee's chairman, Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, announced a pair of articles of impeachment this morning. Nadler echoed his statements from yesterday, pinpointing the argument that President Trump put himself above the law and before the country. Also, in this young week, the Inspector General for the Justice Department released a report on the origins of the FBI investigation into the Trump campaign and Russian election interference in 2016. It found no political bias at the heart of the probe, but did point out some problematic actions by investigators. Paul Nolet is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Well, two huge stories. We'll tackle both of them a little bit today, Paul. First, let's start with the articles of impeachment. What is at the heart of each of the articles here?
Yeah, so there's two articles of impeachment. The first one is abuse of power, and that is really, I think, in some ways, the critical one, because that one gets to the allegation that President Trump used his position as president to try to influence, in this case, Ukraine's actions to get involved in the presidential election, particularly by investigating Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, and his role on a corporation in Ukraine. The second article of impeachment is contempt of Congress, and this has to do with the investigation itself and allegations from Congress that the president was getting in the way of the investigation that Congress was doing of the investigation of President Trump, Hunter Biden, Ukraine, and that entire story. So there's two articles of impeachment. There was some question about whether there were going to be more, but they settled on these two. So they narrowed it down, focused like a laser on the Ukraine issue as opposed to getting into broader issues.
And that obstruction of Congress issue, they made a constitutional argument as I read it, saying, hey, the Constitution says Congress shall have the sole power of impeachment by not allowing White House staff, for example, to testify or sharing documents. The president is asserting that the executive branch has some control over the course of an impeachment. So it's they're saying he's violating the constitutional terms of impeachment, if I have that right.
Yeah, and it really comes down to the fact that the Constitution is very vague in terms of the process used in impeachment. It does say that the House has the sole power of impeachment, as you mentioned, even though executive privilege and similar doctrines are not actually in the Constitution itself. Presidents have long claimed that Congress cannot go beyond its power to invade, essentially, the separation of powers and the ability of the executive to do its own job. So there's definitely that pushback coming from the executive branch in terms of how much they really need to comply with Congress here.
Republicans over the course of the hearing so far have criticized Democrats for moving too quickly with proceedings. As part of the announcement this morning from Democrats, here's what California Representative Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, had to say about that.
The argument, why don't you just wait, amounts to this. Why don't you just let him cheat in one more election? Why not let him cheat just one more time? Why not let him have foreign help just one more time? That is what that argument amounts to.
What do you make, Paul, of the decision not to wait out the courts to see if they can compel members of the White House team to come before Congress and testify?
Yeah, I think from the Democrats' perspective, they said, look, what the Trump administration is doing here is stonewalling. They're just trying to play out the string here by going to the courts, having weeks, months, perhaps even years worth of delays before we can get any additional information. And from the Democrats' perspective, they already have enough evidence to move forward on this. Of course, the Republicans respond by saying, look, you know, there are people that we want to interview, for one thing, not the least of which might be, you know, Hunter Biden and kind of investigating that piece of things as well. And you're not allowing us that opportunity, Democrats. So there's very much the Republicans and Democrats here are almost on different planets in terms of how they're talking about how this process has gone.
Let's give a listen to one of those Republicans now. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, also from California, was at a GOP press conference this morning on a variety of topics. Responding to this announcement, he said a lot of the same things we've heard from Republicans so far, including that Democrats have refused to accept the results of the 2016 election.
Impeachment is the removal of the highest elected person in this land. I don't care if you think Americans who support President Trump are deplorables, but you do not have the right to disqualify their vote just because you do not like President Trump.
And that's at the heart of one of the arguments here, at least, Paul, that, okay, impeachment would override the votes of people in 2016. Democrats saying, well, we're doing this because the president's actions threaten the votes in 2020.
Right, exactly. And I think if the more that this goes into 2020, now I think the House will finish up before the new year, but the Senate trial, if that occurs, will be next year. I think the Republicans' argument about, well, why don't we just let the voters decide? The closer that we get to next November, I think the stronger that argument, at least rhetorically, might be. I do think, you know, Democrats certainly have a point when they push back and they say, well, this isn't overturning the will of the voters, and it's certainly not unconstitutional, given that it is itself impeachment, a constitutional process. And if abuse of power, in the view of Democrats, goes to the level where Congress ought to act about it, then really Congress has an obligation to move forward with impeachment proceedings and perhaps impeachment itself.
Talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at the articles of impeachment released this morning. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Also, yesterday, an inspector general's report in the Justice Department looked at the origins of the Russia probe. This was long awaited. I think in a normal week, Paul, this would be the top story. Now it's just, you know, a top story. Talk about the investigation into the origins of this investigation.
Right. So this report comes out of an internal investigation with the inside the FBI about how they were engaged in the investigation of various Trump aides during the 2016 election. In particular, it focused in on Carter Page, who was a foreign policy advisor for Trump, and one that the FBI had gotten what's known as a FISA warrant, essentially an intelligence warrant to surveil Carter Page. And so Republicans have long complained that this was an example of members of the government proceeding with political bias against the Trump campaign and then administration. And Democrats have said, well, it seems like the FBI had enough to go along here to actually investigate the Trump administration and initially the Trump campaign. So I think overall there's enough from this report that both Democrats and Republicans have taken out of and really highlighted to advance their own arguments about what actually happened here with the Russia investigation.
Let's take each of those in turn, Paul. The key finding, and the FBI director Christopher Wray has highlighted this himself, saying this was not motivated by political bias. That was the finding of the report. Talk about that part of the report before we get to the problems it found in the FBI's approach.
Right. So this is the part that the FBI and a number of Democrats have really highlighted. So the report found that the surveillance of Carter Page and others of the Trump campaign was not motivated by political bias. So they did not find evidence that there was some sort of, you know, deep state conspiracy to go after Trump. So I think that was, in some ways, at least that part of it was a vindication of the FBI, especially against increasing attacks from President Trump himself, who said, hey, all these people within the deep state are out to get me. And so there wasn't any evidence of that in this report.
And the report also found that this was a warranted investigation. There was enough there to open the investigation, but finding some problems, finding some shortcuts taken, documents altered in some of these surveillance request documents, these FISA requests.
Right, exactly. And so this really had to go to the process that the FBI was using in order to start the surveillance of Carter Page. And a lot of it had to do with, their perhaps mischaracterizing the dossier that Christopher Steele, a British intelligence agent, had put together that the FBI had used to essentially get these surveillance warrants, and on the tip that there were connections between perhaps the Russian government and the Trump campaign. And so the findings here were that the process that the FBI went through were flawed, that they overstated some of what was in that Steele dossier, and that certain procedures should be reformed moving forward.
I want to give a listen to President Trump reacting to this report earlier today. He and the attorney general, for that matter, disputed some of the conclusions here. Here's the president.
Well, they fabricated evidence and they lied to the courts and they did all sorts of things to have it go their way. And this was something that we can never allow to happen again. The report actually, and especially when you look into it and the details of the report, are far worse than anything I would have even imagined.
He also said at the time he had yet to get a full briefing on the report, worse than he could have imagined.
Well, I think there's enough there for Trump and Republicans to latch on to complain about the process. But overall, though, looking at this report, I think the thing that really stands out is a broader concern that actually even goes beyond Trump and goes back a few years, which is that the FBI frequently gets these FISA warrants, these intelligence warrants to surveil, and the court that is supposed to be the roadblock to law enforcement doing this is too often a rubber stamp. I mean, some studies have indicated that well over 99% of the FISA warrant requests that come in from the FBI and other law enforcement are granted. So it's almost become routine. So I think in some ways, even though it's become a partisan back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, I do think that there's a bigger issue here about the process of surveillance and intelligence gathering in the United States.
Talking to Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at the two articles of impeachment announced today and a report from the Justice Department looking at the origins of the Russia investigation and Trump campaign that started in 2016. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the two articles of impeachment that have been drafted so far? Should others be added? Should they all be dropped? What do you want to see come out of the House and then the Senate if it goes there? And what's your reaction to this Inspector General report saying political bias wasn't behind the 2016 Russia probe, but there were problems with some of the procedures here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with Marquette University political science professor Paul Nolet, looking at articles of impeachment announced today from the U.S. House Judiciary Committee and a new Department of Justice report on the FBI's investigation of then-candidate Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. You can join in on either topic at 800-642-1234. How closely are you following the impeachment process? What do you want to see come out of this? What do you think of the two articles of impeachment we have released today? Drafts of those released today. And what do you think about the Inspector General's report on the origins of the investigation into Russian election interference and the Trump campaign? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just going to ask your guest, the impeachment process appeared extremely biased and unfair. Because it was controlled by the Democrats in the House. Does he think that the Senate trial will be just as biased and unfair in the Senate, or are we going to try to approach some type of civility and try to get along to make this not so much a political weapon and something that we can avoid in the future?
Charlie,
thank you.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's take that in two parts, Paul. Let's start with the House. Republicans certainly making the case over the last couple of weeks that Democrats have steamrolled them, not given them a fair shake in the various hearings. What do you make of that concern?
Yeah, and I think the issue both in the House and potentially in the Senate is that, you know, I think this sort of process is inevitably biased in the sense that the majority gets to control the show. The House constitutionally has the sole power of impeachment. The Senate has the sole power to try impeachments, which means that they can create the process that they wish to see. So I think Democrats in the House are going to create a process that's most advantageous to them in the House. And I think that was true by and large. They got more witnesses. They controlled the pace of the proceedings. In the Senate, I think you'll see the same thing on the Republican side, where Republicans will create a process that's most advantageous to them, with Democrats complaining. So it's one of these things that often the impeachment process is likened to a court trial, like in the judiciary, but while there are some similarities, it is a very, very political process. And in these polarized times, you're going to have that partisanship and that polarization really come out.
Now, in the Senate, assuming it goes there, which is not a done deal yet, the impeachment articles would have to be voted on and passed on from the House. But leading Republicans in the Senate have been talking to the White House. Some reporting coming out saying that President Trump wants a longer trial with lots of witnesses. The Senate Republican leadership may want a faster deal without calling lots of witnesses on either side. What do you make of that back and forth?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, and it'll be very interesting to see to what extent the Senate leaders, like Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, how much he takes the cue from the president or tries to set up a process that, in his view, is most advantageous for the Republicans. I think all things being equal, I think from Mitch McConnell's point of view, a shorter trial makes a lot more sense because just strategically, because there's less chance of surprises coming up and fewer chances for the Democrats to step in and try to make some of their case. So I think ultimately, even though President Trump is saying, oh, I want to have this long trial, my guess is that it's going to be on the shorter side.
Charlie, thanks for that call. We're talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at the big national stories. Two articles of impeachment out today. Big report out from the Department of Justice Inspector General. Back to your calls. Chris is with us in Neshota. Chris, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Chris?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that we're somewhat vindicated that, the investigation by the FBI was appropriate. However, I'm troubled by the fact that procedures weren't exactly followed. I think that gives Republicans more ammunition. That's really not necessary. Procedures should have been followed. And also, I've been listening very closely to the impeachment hearings. Most people aren't actually listening. Although I think President Trump should be impeached, I think the Republicans do have some valid points as far as some procedures also there that should be followed that aren't being followed.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. So Chris, ultimately in favor of impeaching the president, but she wanted it done right and maybe is worried that it wasn't done right, Paul.
Yeah, it's I think when it comes to impeachment, this inherently political process that it's not terribly surprising that Democrats and Republicans are on two different planets as far as how they think the fairness of this impeachment process has gone. I think it's in some ways there's a couple of things going on here that Chris mentioned, two different processes. One, on the impeachment side, where the House really has the full ability to control the process in the way that it wants. And then as far as the FBI getting surveillance warrants, which really is a process that I think is particularly concerning since the judiciary, the special court, is supposed to be involved and be a roadblock and just isn't in when it comes to these FISA warrants. And again, I think this goes beyond Trump and Carter Page and the 2016 election to point to some broader problems within the process of surveillance in the United States. So I think Chris is absolutely right that there's some issues with the process, both on the impeachment side, I think particularly on the FISA warrant side, that should be looked into going forward.
Thanks for that call, Chris. Paul, just a few moments left. So next steps, we'll see the House deal with these articles of impeachment. Another report apparently coming from the Department of Justice, instigated by Attorney General Barr. What's at the top of your mind in the next, 2 weeks? That seems like a long time in American politics these days.
Yeah, probably a lot will happen. I do fully expect at this point within the next week and a half that the Judiciary Committee in the House will vote on these two articles of impeachment, and then the full House shortly after will. So it'll be turned over to the Senate by the end of the year. So what I'd look for is an indication, going back to a point that we talked a little bit about before, is, how long does it look like this trial is going to be? Is it going to be a trial with lots and lots of witnesses that goes on weeks, or is this going to be something that, is wrapped up in a month or even less? So I think that's one big thing there. And then when it comes to the FBI, it'll be interesting to see how Bill Barr, the Attorney General, continues to handle these reports for instance, the Inspector General's report from the FBI, because he was in some ways almost shockingly critical of, the FBI within his own Department of Justice over the last 24 hours or so. So any additional comment from Bill Barr, the Attorney General, on this will be interesting to follow.
Paul, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
It's Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, with us to talk about impeachment and the Department of Justice Inspector General report. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get the latest on impeachment, plus the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement and other top stories in our weekly roundup of big news in national politics. That and lots more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, the head of Wisconsin's National Guard is out after a national report critical of the Guard's handling of sexual assault accusations. Kate talks to a reporter who's been following that story. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, affordable housing is in increasingly short supply for many working people and senior citizens in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a Republican and a Democratic state lawmaker about how they think the state should deal with that problem. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.